listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is coming live from the Badoc Beer Brewing Company. I am Scott Phillips and he is...
Andrew Page.
And we are live. Thank you all for being here. Now, if you're listening to this afterwards, you realize we made it out alive and it all went very, very well. If you're not hearing this, that's because we didn't record it or we did it badly and we're going to have to do it all again. We are going to try and do our level best. You know that I am from The Motley Fool. You know what The Motley Fool is. Just for the listeners at home, I'm going to have a bit of audience participation right now. Where's that bloke from? Come on, come on, come on.
If you don't answer it, he's going to do the thing. So answer it.
Apparently he's from strawman.com. If you can't hear at home, our audience are asking what is strawman, which is a very, very good question because I'm not sure we've ever entertained that question on the podcast. Does anyone know what strawman.com is? No, a Bitcoin thing. These are the answers I'm getting so far. I'm sorry.
Andrew,
you're going to have to tell the punters. What is strawman.com?
Do we go with private or premium in the end? I think it's a private online investment club. Premium private online investment club.
That could work. Yeah. You should use that.
I'm going to stick with that.
Yep. All right. We are here live. We are going to record two episodes. So if you're listening to this at home, this is the first of two. We will do our regular Friday podcast and then we will do our mailbag, which hopefully will be full of questions from the people here at the Badoc Beer Brewing Company who have hopefully some very, very good questions for us. You can be the judge of that a bit later. Ram, let's start off as we regularly do with the macro.
The macro. The well-rehearsed
macro. Yeah, he's looking over my shoulder macro, here.
Yeah.
I will say, by the way, he does a very, very good job. When we do the agenda, I write it up. It's on my computer. He's at the other end of a Zoom call. And he has to kind of make do. Same with the questions. When you guys ask mailbag questions, he doesn't see them until I ask them. So he does a pretty good job, I reckon. Mate, two bits of information since we last did our podcast. The first is the unemployment numbers, which came out last Thursday and fell from 4.1% to 3.7% in what is otherwise, in theory, a cooling economy.
Mm.
Now, we know those unemployment numbers were partly because the January numbers were too high. The ABS at the time had already said there is going to be a whole lot of people who've accepted jobs, who are ready to start jobs that haven't yet commenced to work. And yet, 100,000 jobs created, two-thirds full-time, one-third part-time.
Yep.
The participation rate wasn't a contributor this time around. A genuine drop in unemployment. Is it too early to think there are some green shoots? Are we coming out of the bad stuff, or is this maybe, just maybe, a little bit of false news that may well prove to not be true in the fullness of time?
Well, I'm going to do my best to put a negative spin on it because that's what I do.
That's what you do.
No, but I think it's pretty good. I mean, what was it at before it dropped down?
4.1 down to 3.7.
I mean, I'm old enough to remember that 5% unemployment rate was considered full employment.
Yeah.
And so we're already fully employed and now we're even more fully employed. So it's kind of... Yeah, it's good news, but it's hard to sort of take that as in, oh, things are really bad and now they're really good.
Yeah.
Things are sort of were good and they're still pretty good.
Yeah.
So yeah, but to make it a glass half empty, you know, there's not a lot of capacity there in the workforce. So that's probably going to be inflationary.
That's the problem.
And that's probably going to put up interest rates.
Yeah.
So there's...
Put up interest rates or delay the decline?
Or delay the decline, okay. Potentially.
Okay.
But I mean, this is... I can't think of a single economic topic where it isn't a two-sided coin.
Mm.
You can always go, there's that.
Yep.
But on the other hand, there's that. So, but yeah, it's a good result. It's almost too good.
One of the things I've heard recently, I think it's one of those kind of things that is a favorite line of a particular brand of economics. I don't know which, but I kind of hear it regularly enough that it's a bit of a go-to. But there are no solutions. There are just trade-offs.
Yes.
I kind of like that line. I don't know if it lends itself to a particular school of thinking. I don't really care. But it's just it's an appropriate line. It's a nice line because it talks to that very reality, as you highlight, of what's left for us is a choice between two things. And I don't know we should necessarily... agree that we have to trade off on an absolute basis just because the orthodoxy says it's true, just because economists say this is real. And yet it seems very real to me, relatively obvious that you only get 3.7% unemployment or 3.5% unemployment when the economy is running that hot. That's kind of the point, right? That's and when you have resource constraints, when supply is outstripped by demand, that's exactly when you would expect that sort of thing to happen. When you run out of workers who are trained, available in your area, that's not necessarily causing inflation, but it's very symptomatic of exactly that, surely.
Yeah. I mean, I come back to the point where I almost reject the premise of the question that there is something that needs to be managed in terms of, you know, there is a natural order of things, I would say, that if I start a business and it goes well and I need help, I will advertise for jobs and I will pay as little as I possibly can, and the worker on the other side will demand as much as they can. There's been a natural tension.
Yeah.
But they're acting in their self-interest. I'm acting in my self-interest. I couldn't give a stuff about the wider economy, you know? And amazingly, that works as a bottom-up phenomena, as a really organic thing. It's just a very human thing that we are trading, whether it be our time, our labor, our resources. And it's where I get a little bit philosophical with it all, is that when a bureaucrat comes in and says, well, we need to manage this, and I mean, should government play a role in fostering the appropriate conditions for work? Sorry, I'm going to do this a lot. I'll be careful. You know, yes, should they make sure proper training's in place and all of these kinds of things? But when you start, I think the biggest tragedies happen for the best of intentions, right? And you go, oh, there's not enough people employed, or there's too many people employed. Let's put interest rates up. Too many people have jobs. I mean, I don't know if that is that mean.
You're
Does that
a
sound
cynic.
Crazy?
You're a cynic.
And then, like, but if it's if it isn't crazy, I would love for someone to go, well, no, what you don't understand is this, and blah 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 blah. I've never had anyone be able to do that for me.
For listeners at home, Andrew is playing up to the crowd massively right now. He's looking people in the eyes, using his arms. He's looking to foment a revolution here at the Madoc Beer Brewing Company.
I just think there's not enough. There's too much. We have physics envy in this domain, and we look at the physicists who have these beautiful, elegant, perfect equations that map onto reality, and we go, we want that as well. So we're going to have our models and our formulas, and that's fine. Like, it's a noble kind of aspiration to build. Maths builds a lot of understanding. These frameworks can be very helpful. But then we start mistaking our modeling for reality, and we start thinking that we have control over these things. And I know we often go in this direction
when
we have this conversation, but it is, I find myself, I don't know how else to engage with the question, because I feel as though if you start with that very narrow and, I think, incorrect Keynesian kind of framework of, here's a set of macro indicators and here's how we need to manage them and this is what we need to do about that, I think is fundamentally misplaced as an ideology. So there you go. I'm putting that out there.
That's fair. See, Andrew is officially against the minimum wage, people. He doesn't want government intervention. He wants us all to be wage slaves.
Too often it gets classed, oh, it's a libertarian. I couldn't be further from a libertarian. I really couldn't. But it is. But they have some good points. I'll say that much.
The inevitable slide continues, people. Let's go to the other bit of big news that was out actually today. We're recording this on Wednesday evening. And we had inflation data out today for the third month in a row. The monthly inflation indicator, which is not the perfect one. It only has about 70% of the usual quarterly one. So some of the data just isn't available yet. 3.4% for the third month in a row. Some claiming that as a big victory. By the way, the share market was up today on that news. So you can take that for some degree of sentiment, at least among equity investors. It's good that it didn't go higher. Yes. It's not great that it didn't go lower. Here's the twist in the tail, though. Callum Pickering, who's a real estate economist, actually tweeted during the day that if we stayed at this current monthly inflation level, so not the annual is 3.4%, the monthly is much smaller. If we could stay at that inflation level for another 3 or 6 months, inflation might have a 2 in front of it and potentially a very low 2 if it hung around for another 6 months. So I guess a couple of things. Firstly, it tells us what we need to think about when we see some of these numbers highlighted, right? On a yearly basis, feels the same, therefore inflation's not going down. But every time, I've said this before, every time we add a month of data, we take off the same month of the previous year. And we kind of roll forward caterpillar style, right? Drop one, pick up one, drop one, pick up one. We could be, if you annualize the current inflation rate, we're definitely at a 2 point something over 6 months. If you annualize the 1 month inflation rate, we're under 2%. Now, no one's silly enough to believe 1 month's inflation, 31 days, is going to give you your annual inflation rate. But it does suggest things are coming down quite quickly. Furniture was down minus 0.3% over the month. Most things were down or stable year on year. A couple were up, fuel was up, and that's always the most volatile one. But you start to strip that back, and we're getting close to something. Now, again, if you're a regular listener, and you are, so thank you for turning up, you know that Andrew is not a fan of central banking, and that's his mistake, not mine. But the inflation number, so let's step aside from the policy implications, just talk about the inflation number itself. Is the crisis over? Are we done? What happens next?
I don't know. I mean, it was interesting when I met you in the office this afternoon. You were saying, interestingly enough, Australian food inflation hasn't been that bad compared to other...
Don't misquote me. I said it wasn't as bad as others. Not
wasn't as bad wasn't as others. Bad. And I said, oh, that's interesting. And you showed me a chart.
Yeah.
And we weren't. We haven't been as bad as the US, Europe, and elsewhere.
Correct.
But I mean, this is like not a newsflash to anyone who lives in the real world. But what the graph showed was that your groceries are 20% more expensive than pre-pandemic. So I've always had an issue with the language that's used around here, because we said it, you just said it then. I know you're technically correct, because inflation is a vector of change.
Yes.
And so—
So I'm right.
So you're technically right, which is the best kind of right, I suppose.
Not technically right, I'm actually right.
You're right.
Okay.
But in the real world, inflation isn't coming down. Prices.
Inflation's the coming rate, down. Prices aren't coming down.
I'm going to grab your thumb. I'm going to put it in a thumb screw. I'm going to tighten it. And then I'm going to stop tightening it as much as I was tightening. I'm going to say, see, what are you complaining about? The rate of tightening has slowed. There's no loosening here. I'm still tightening. I'm only tightening at 3%. So there's that. Okay. So what does it mean next for inflation? I don't know. We've talked about it a bit on the pod, where you have these impulses that might result from temporary dislocations, shocks to trade routes and all of this kind of stuff.
Yep.
Puts the price of everything up, which is a good thing. Price is sending a signal there. We don't have enough. There's more demand than supply. People who do the supply notice that signal. They make more supply. Mm-hmm. It brings the price down.
That's lithium 101, right? We've seen that over the last 24 months.
It's economics 101.
Right.
Like there's very few, as I said, we've got physics envy, but when it comes to supply and demand, we've got that. Like that's ours.
Yeah,
like
that is, as it gets.
Take that to the bank. Yeah. Supply and demand's a pretty good, theory. I've lost my point entirely, haven't I?
You were saying I was right, I think, as I recall.
Where was I going?
You were whinging about inflation not coming down and how I was in thumb screws and...
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, it was a really interesting point, and now it's gone.
So there was some data in the Australian Financial Review today showing that between January 2020, so effectively pre-pandemic, right? We know what happened there, and December 2023. So for that 4-year period, Australian grocery prices, or food prices, I should say, not grocery, were up about 19-odd%. I'm trying to read a graph here, by the way, for anyone who's wondering. And it was lower than New Zealand, which is up 25%. The UK, almost 30%. The EU, more than 30% compound over 4 years. Imagine being on a minimum income, a low income in the EU, paying 30% more for your food. In Canada, up by 23-odd%, and the US about 25%. So again,
that is saying you've got nothing to complain about, because at least you're not Europe.
No, that's your interpretation.
And I would say, yeah, but it still sucks.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I remember my point eventually.
We're all relieved, aren't we, Ted?
My point was that you have these impulses that send prices higher. It's a temporary thing, but it makes it harder. And so people will then have a case to demand for higher wages.
Yeah.
And then they will often be successful in that. And then their costs, their wage is someone else's cost.
Yep.
Part of the cost of production that will get passed on to a higher, stickier level of price rise, because people don't tend to get pay cuts. It's a ratchet. It goes in one direction. I'm not saying it shouldn't, by the way. But again, you have this, when you say, what does this mean for inflation?
Yep.
And back to the very first point, I don't know. It feels like unemployment's about as low as it can possibly go. And we still haven't had a lot of these pay rises wash through the system. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of people out there who have gotten pay rises who would go, well, thanks for the 5%, but my groceries are 20% more expensive now.
Exactly.
I think when you cut away all the guff and you look at it long term and you you remove your individual self from the equation, because we all look at it through our own lens. Because some people, whenever you have this conversation, some people either go, yeah, I've never had it better. What are you talking about? Or no, it's really hard. And it's like, well, you're both right in your context. Mm-hmm. But on average, we're all worse off. And
correct.
And I suspect that will continue to get worse off, because as people demand more wage rises, as that goes into the higher cost of production and then the higher cost of goods, it gets into that spiral kind of thing. And yeah, it's a consequence. None of these things happen in isolation. So the issues that we've talked about this a lot that we're dealing with right now were policy decisions that were made 5 and yes. 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yes.
And unfortunately, we look back at that, and I don't think it's too controversial a statement to say that. You know, even we'll agree on that, right? And yet, when we're having these problems now, we go, oh, let's do the same thing. You know that thing that didn't work in 2008 and 2002 and, you know, 1987, like didn't work? Let's do that again. And then let's have another crisis in 5 to 10 years. And I know it sounds cynical and pessimistic, but am I wrong?
So you're cynical and pessimistic? Absolutely not. You're definitely right. You are cynical and pessimistic. Yes, you know I have a different view on that, which is we don't know the counterfactual to any of those circumstances. And you know, you agree with that. You may be absolutely 100% right that absent those interventions, things are better now. It's also possible that they're worse now. I think that's the challenge for policymakers, is how involved do you get? What do you do? You want to get involved, you want to make some change, you want to make things better. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. And you're right. There are, as we said before, there are no choices, no solution, only choices. There are only yes. trade-offs. And I think that matters a lot. But
I think what's implicit in, and I think what's a hard pill for a lot of us to swallow, is that there will be bad outcomes no matter what.
Yes.
There just will be.
For some people in some circumstances, yes.
And it's a good thing, if I can put it that way. I mean, if it wasn't a good thing, we would still be out there defending the rights of horseshoe makers. You know, like, it just, the world has moved on, and the economy, well, you, all of us, are signaling every day, I demand this, I want this, economy, provide me this. And you say that with your money. The money is communicating to everyone else. And when we get these issues where it's like, oh, this group over here is having trouble. Mm. And I'm not saying we just throw them to the wolves. You know, there's retraining, there's all kinds of support, good social security, welfare networks, the rest of it. So sorry, I told you I'm going to stick it on my chin.
We are doing some, for those at home, we're doing some microphone technique training live here.
Yeah.
Go on.
But it's, the economists call it creative destruction almost. Yep. You need that washing, because what tends to happen is through this process, and I'm talking at a macro lens, you get the bad is washed out, the malinvestment, the person, the business, the company that's producing a good or service that no one wants because no one wants it. You know, when we're supporting these kinds of things, we are diverting very precious resources to other things that people clearly do want. It's like, well, what about the poor auto workers in Adelaide? And it's like, my heart bleeds for them, but they're not competitive. They just can't produce a car as good or as cheap as Toyota, period. They can't. So does that mean that I should, or we should as a community, support a entire industry of, I don't know, cross-stitch artists and have market stalls all around the country because it's good for the economy. We need these people have jobs and families and it's like, it's all true, but it's kind of like let me put this a different way. We can't escape failure. And it's a consequence of saying, well, do we want failure where failure is appropriate? Mm. And do we want to make sure that we help people deal with that failure? Or do we want to make sure that no one ever feels any pain and we solve everything? Well, if we could do the latter, that'd be great. We can't do the latter. And when we try and do the latter, that's when we sow the seeds of our own problems, would be my argument.
Or some solutions, but I take your point. I want to take a jump off here, actually, because you talk about the auto workers in Adelaide. Does everyone here read Ross Gittins? I hope so. Does anyone not? If you don't, get
sure.
No, I'm kidding. You should. He's great. He was writing the other day. No, he was speaking the other day. Sorry. He was on the, speaking of podcasts, Richard Feidler's Conversations podcast. A couple of nodding heads around here. Do yourself a favor. Finish this podcast and Sunday's podcast first, and then go and listen to this one. He talked about the, and we've talked about this before, mate, so I'm basically just using Ross Gittins to advance my own point because, hey, why would you not? Talk about the urge to make stuff, right? Now, there are probably people here in the manufacturing industry, and that's great. We need some of that stuff being done, right? The reality is we are not an economy that supports the making of stuff unless it's super high value, super niche, super profitable, given the size of our market, the size of our manufacturing industry, the distance to some of the markets around the world. We don't have an economy that supports the making of things without mass subsidies or diverting people away from other more productive uses. And Gittins' point, which again I'm using just because it's my point, I'd like to make him the bad guy rather than me, is making stuff is great if you can do it successfully. But every time you say, let's take a tax subsidy, let's apply a tariff, what we're doing is making ourselves poorer to support an uneconomic job rather than, to Ram's point, I don't agree entirely with his black and white view, but directionally, we're on the same page, which is you can actually have those people employed more profitably for them and for the economy, which, guess what, raises our entire standard of living, which takes us right back to inflation, because the reality is the inflation, let's take food inflation. I mean, you're absolutely right. I think you're a little bit direct with the old inflation curse problem. But the fact that prices are up 20% over 4 years doesn't go away. That's the best part of 15 years, maybe, of living standard improvements washed away in 4 years. And to Ram's point, prices aren't going to go down, right? So we're stuck with that. We've literally gone backwards by 20%. And we'll make that back with a bit of productivity and a bit of pay rise. And a bit of whatever else happens after that, some new product or something else, some cost savings, hopefully. And eventually, 10 years' time, maybe 10, 15 is probably too pessimistic. In 10 years' time, we'll make that back. But it's going to take 10 years, over which time we could have started from zero and gone ahead that 20%, rather than having to make it up and then try and get gains from there. It's why inflation is so terrible. And while Ram and I have a different, you know, solution to the problem, the reality is once you give that up, prices don't come down. He's absolutely right. And we've given it up, and so you've got to try and make that back and try and make it work. And without that change, it really makes things very, very difficult to try and get back on that horse. And so whether it's food, travel, accommodation, here's the big one, right? So we try desperately not to be totally ideological and certainly not political. The whole wage price spiral thing, right? We know about the wage price spiral, and people say the wage price spiral didn't cause inflation. That is absolutely 100% correct. It did not. Wages did not cause inflation. But guess what? Inflation is now 3.4% and coming down. The wage case, employers are saying not more than 2.8. You're just saying we want 5. Government's going to go somewhere in between. Is it likely to be higher than the annual inflation rate? Yeah. So what does that mean? It means another year of higher inflation. Now, should people be made whole for the gaps in the last 4 years? Arguably, sure. We'd like that to be true. But if we were to do that, does it not just prolong the inflationary cycle? Yeah, it does. Now, the lessons we have to learn, again, to Ram's point, we disagree on a lot, we agree on even more, is how do we get there? How do we stop it happening again? Because that's gone. If we make people whole for the 20% of grocery prices, we're going to have 7, 8% inflation or 4.5% inflation for another 2 years, by which time we're looking at even more inflation and more pay rises, and that is the spiral. It shouldn't be called a wage price spiral, it should be called a price wage spiral. Because that's actually the order in which it will happen if it's allowed to roll out. Treasury's already said, you've heard this on the pod, last year, they said that wages are now a major contributor to inflation. Does that mean people who are doing it tough shouldn't be paid more? No. We've got to make some sort of deal with ourselves here, because on one level, any extra dollar that goes into wages will probably go into prices, that'll probably go into inflation, and it'll probably go into next year's wage claim. On the flip side, how can I sit here and say, as I just said, think about Europe and Ram's point about Australia is true. There are people on minimum wage, there are people doing it really, really tough, who are paying 20% more for groceries than they were 4 years ago. With what money? Right? They're cutting out heating. They're not doing the things. These are real issues for real people caused by the inflation that spiked, probably to Ram's point, from part of the solutions from the past one. I would argue they were probably justified and we're just having to deal with the results. Ram would say they weren't justified at all. We should have taken the pain earlier. In either a case, we're in exactly the same situation, which is we have an issue to try and deal with, to try and recover from in the least painful way possible, whichever solution you come with. And I think this is the challenge with economics. I have a view, Ram has a view, the RBA has a view. Turns out they get to make the decision, we just do a podcast. So maybe that says more about us than them, I'm not sure. But that's the challenge that we have when it comes to some of this macro stuff, is it's really, really difficult. Mate,
Yeah, and I just, on that, we always circle back to the same point.
We do.
Because you gotta, as an investor, it's always about understanding the things that you can control. and other things that just are.
Yep.
And you've got to recognize the world as it is, not as you would have it. And you need to act in a way, not only in recognizing that, but also recognizing that we can pontificate up here for hours and what's going to happen and be completely wrong. And because every expert is always wrong, almost, you know, and when they're not, it's just pure chance.
Yep.
So it always comes back to, just to put a so what on the end of it, is just that anti-fragility that you want to build in your life. Because you can't, you know, some numpty in Martin Place is going to make a decision at some point, and you got no control over that. But you can decide not to, like, leverage yourself 99% against something that's negative cash flow.
Oh dear.
Something.
Someone timestamp. This is the point at which the podcast went very much downhill. I banned him from the B word at least for the next little while, but we'll see whether it makes an appearance.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Audience participation time. Show of hands, and I will share it with our listeners at home. Who here paid with cash over the bar today? One hand. Literally one hand. People at home, we have 4,000 people. No, I'm kidding. There's probably, what is there, 40 people, 50 people here?
80?
No. 40, 50 people here. One person paid with cash over the bar. I mentioned that because, and I asked the question because, Armaguard, the cash transport business, is on the brink of collapse, which is a hell of a thing if you really think about that. I mean, I'm not much older than him, even though I look much older than him. And I vividly remember the very first FPOS machine I ever saw. It was in an army disposal store. I was a scout when I was a kid, so, you know, 85 years ago. And I remember I saw this machine, and I remember the guy, it was, you know, he runs an army disposal store, a bit of a nerdy guy, which is great. So I was like, mate, you know, I think mum or dad might have said, you know, what's this? And he sat me and showed me. He's like, oh, you do this, you press the buttons. And it was mind-blowing, right? We used to, again, because I'm old, we used to have notes, physical notes, in the ashtray of the old 8Z Holden Kingswood when I was a kid. And you put the petrol money in there, right? And you'd fill up the car, and you'd have to fill to exactly $20, because that's how much money you had. That's the cash you had to pay with, right? Not that many years later, believe it or not, we're now at a point where one person at the bar is paid with cash. Armaguard cannot turn a profit trucking our cash around the country. And one third of the ATMs have gone over the last 5 years or so. It is an extraordinary change to the way we live our lives. And I think we've talked a lot about innovation. We've talked a lot about technology. We've talked about iPhones, for example. iPhones are 16 years old. Something ridiculously small, right? Can you remember a time when you didn't have one of these in front of you? He says, holding up an iPhone that people at home can't see. Not an iPhone, it's an Android phone. But there was a time, right? And I think there's a couple of lessons here. First of all, we'll talk about the cash bit without mentioning the other thing. We will, but the bigger picture here is the pace of innovation for me. It's the things that we, you know, we're not still drawing flying cars, despite the promise of the Jetsons, and I'm still a little bit cranky at George for that one. But the pace of innovation, the things we take for granted so incredibly quickly. Podcast didn't exist a decade ago. Yeah. By the way, funny inside story. We got a phone call from one of the content director at Triple M Sydney. And he called me. He said, oh, it's Mike Fitzpatrick here from Triple M. I said, okay, g'day, mate. He said, do you want to do a podcast? I said, I don't know. He said, do you want to give it a go? I said, oh, I suppose. Yeah, when you're getting off like that, of course you're going to have a go. Podcast is young. No one's doing it. It's kind of, you know, it's one of those things. I said to Ram in his first time when he was with us at the Fool, I said, do you want to do a podcast? Said, yeah, okay, I'll do that. That's how we're doing this podcast now in front of you guys. So that was a fateful call. Had they not called me, I don't know whether we would have done a podcast. Maybe by now we would have tried to do something, but that's the origin. Technology.
Five people on my street who do a podcast.
That's true too.
We would have done a podcast.
Four of them are him under his different guises. The pace of technology, though, is incredible. And so I guess, mate, I'll ask you about the death of cash without mentioning the other thing. You can mention at the end, I promise. And then I want to talk about innovation. So just you know, Armaguard, what does it do? I mean, it's potentially pretty seismic if banks and retailers can't get cash around the country.
Yeah, I mean, it is gone already. I mean, the saying is the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed. And we're at the front in Australia. Like, there's like, you'd be surprised in the States how many people use checks.
That's true.
You know, let alone cash. It's bizarre. But you know, most of these changes, we always, whatever the technology, we assume this sort of linear thing, but it's not. It's an S curve. It's nothing, something, and then it's just normal again. And that is, look, predicting the future is hard, but I'm going to go there and say, there is no cash in 10 years.
Oh, no cash.
There's no cash.
All right. Audience participation time again. Who reckons Cash is dead inside 10 years? Show of hands. I reckon about
all the smart ones.
People.
Count the smart ones. Yeah.
There is definitely a revolution being fomented tonight. Who reckons 20 years?
Who reckons never?
Yeah, that's the next question.
Ah.
A few heads. So about maybe a third of the audience.
We're talking digital cash, just to be clear.
Let's move on. We'll cut that one out. A third of the audience roughly inside 10 years, another third or so inside 20, and a few saying never.
No, it's gone.
Happens.
It's gone. It is gone for purely economic reasons.
That's the thing.
Armaguard is having to be subsidized because they need that service. It's like all the banks are closing their branches in regional areas. We talked about that on the pod recently. Why? No, because they're assholes. Well, they are assholes, but not because they're assholes. They're doing that. They're doing it because they don't make any money. Like, they're not doing it. Like, why? You know. So.
I challenge your assumption.
And the only reason we do that is because there is a political will at this point. Just like, well, what about grandma and granddad?
Yeah.
We can't throw them to the wolves. Granted, I'm not saying we should, but that's the only thing. The dam wall is that, right? Yeah. Yeah. And once that sunrise sunset that passes, then no. Why would you? And it's not as though it'll be a bloody revolution. No one wants it. I mean, no one here wanted it. One person put their hand up. And why? Because it's easier to go tap, tap, tap and have it all there and audited and on a budget, and just it's so much easier. It is 100% gone. And then there's cool stuff you can do with not the other thing. And not really cool at all. In fact, Orwellian scary stuff.
Well, that's
because what you can do with CBDCs, which are coming, they're already the RBA is working on it.
Central bank digital currencies for those who don't live in Bitcoin land.
It's programmable money, and it's got all the features of cash.
Yeah.
Except it's controlled by the RBA, and it's not a conspiratorial thing. It's just what it is.
Yeah.
But it gives you. It will. I imagine it will come in under a banner of. Well, it allows us to do this and allows us to do that. But it also comes with incredible control mechanisms as well. And you can see what they're doing in China and other places which have a form of this. So I think it's something that will be, again, I really don't wear a tinfoil hat, but you've got-
sort of virtual one is digital these days, you know.
One of the challenges of living in Australia, which is so great in so many different ways and why everyone wants to come here, is that we've got it so good. But there's not a big gap to cross between what we have and what other places. Even like look at what happened in Hong Kong not too long ago. What's happening there? So this is Hong Kong. It's a first world country, right?
Isn't that an argument against the getting rid of cash? So aren't there going to be a group of people who some will obviously go to digital currencies, of which we won't mention. Others will though say, "I'm going to stay with cash because I don't want that level of control."
Yeah, but
control.
They won't have a choice. Well, no one's accepting it anymore. You can't get it out anyway. The banks aren't stocking it anymore. That's the problem. Armaguard's not shipping it around anymore. And it's not that there is someone will do something wrong with it, but something could do something wrong with it. The wonderful thing I have about cash is I can pull out a pineapple from my wallet and I can give it to anyone, and it's only between me and that person.
Who wants it? Who wants the 50? Hands up, everybody.
I don't carry cash.
Hey, we checked into the hotel together this afternoon and he insisted on using his digital ID. And then he insisted on tapping as he doesn't carry cards anymore. So there you go.
Just to make a point. And took five times as long as it took you. But I did it.
I wasn't going to say that. You did. You made your point.
But it's one of those things. You're seeing it play out in the US a little bit now with some of the stuff that Trump is saying. Not to get political, but it is a fine line. I'm going to forget the quote here, but we take certain liberties for granted, and I think it's something that we should fight for, to have cash around, because there is something that I think it's a fundamental human right for me to take the money that I have earned to spend it in a way that is appropriate without someone having the capacity to control or see what I'm doing. Am I buying drugs and doing all kinds? No, I'm not, but still, none of your bloody business, right? Now, others go, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, so I don't care. But I just think we'll wait until the people that you don't like are in power. And then they do start thinking about, well, you're protesting in the main street because of climate change, for example, something you passionately believe in. And the government of the day says, we don't want to do that. So you can't actually spend your money in the CBD. You can't catch a tram there anymore. You can't do that. In fact, now we're going to dock you your social credit. You know, it gets very dark very quickly. So I just think it is something that will happen almost quietly and with a murmur, but cash will go, and I think we need to be vigilant as to what replaces it.
I'm sure you have no idea about the
other thing. I mean, it's a massive tailwind for the other thing. It just is.
It's
for a lot of people in our situation, it is a solution that doesn't have a problem in front of it.
Yeah.
But for a lot of other people, it's very different. And then when that flips around potentially a little bit, and all of a sudden it's like, I wouldn't mind actually having a little bit of privacy in my life. It sort of drives that kind of thing. So
no, I agree with that, actually. It's absolutely a tailwind for that.
Yeah, it is.
Hey, let's go to investing more purely after it's kind of covering the waterfront so far this evening. Mates, mergers and demergers are back with a massive vengeance. On the ASX.
It always comes in cycles.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I've got to say, I said to you earlier today, I was really surprised. If I was going to be a private equity buyer in particular, or a trade buyer in general, the time to buy these things would have been money was really, really cheap. If you could find an ongoing business that had something going for it, share prices were down through the back of the pandemic. Interest was, you know, zero at central bank level, a couple of percent. I think Apple did a 100-year debt issuances at 1% or something stupid. And if you're going to be a buyer of an asset, that's the time if you're really, in theory, these private equity guys are supposed to be the masters of the universe and have all of that great, you know, ability and everything else to go and make those purchases. And I was kind of waiting for it, and nothing happened. But all of a sudden this year, and I suspect it's because they can now see through the dark clouds, and because maybe there's an assumption that rates aren't going up anymore, so they kind of have a sense of their maximum exposure. Now, they can go up, of course, but they probably won't. So they have a sense of their maximum exposure. I just wrote a quick list before we did this, mate. Altium is coming off the ASX. MMA Great Offshore, stock. The business known as Mermaid Marine. McGrath announced this week was being taken over by Knight Frank.
Not a great stock.
Newmont, the gold miner. API. Plenty of others besides little businesses. Healthscope is dealing with issues. Optus may be bought by Brookfield. Now, again, it's owned by Singtel, so it's not an ASX-listed company. But again, moving from the realm of the public markets to the private markets. It's a speaking of thinking into the future, mate, there is a future, I reckon, in the not too distant, one option of 10 years, 15 years hence. Australia's been talking about a tie-up with the Singapore Stock Exchange for ages.
Mm.
And National Interest Grounds, the government said, no, we want our own exchange. Now, we all want that. I'd like that because it kind of keeps me in a job. All those things are true. But at some point, if we keep losing some of these large Australian businesses, and small ones, frankly, Atlassian lists overseas directly. These guys are being bought up. Now, that moves in cycles. There will be times when there are no deals being done again. And I'm not predicting the end of the world, certainly not the end of the ASX. But if you kind of think far enough forward and think, if the big, well-known, large capitalization companies go private one way or the other, it does make you wonder what's left for the ASX. Are you seeing trends? Are you seeing themes? Are you having thoughts about what's happening in terms of the way corporate money is being thrown around?
I mean, it definitely goes in cycles, and there's different strategies that are in vogue. So, you know, it's always funny to see a company rationalize. Like, I was talking about McGrath with you before, right? So they listed not that long ago, and you read the prospectus, and it's like access to capital markets. We can now do this. It's going to accelerate our strategy. Oh, it's brilliant. It's a list. You've got to be listed. Now it's like, yeah, you don't want to be listed. It's too much compliance. And it's like, wait a second, but you just, you know, so it there is seemingly good articulations of why we need to do this. And I feel as though it's the consultants that really end up making the money in the whole thing.
Yeah.
And there's usually a certain kind of magic that's involved in the math. So it's like 1 + 1 = 3. Essentially, we take this business, and the sum of the parts is worth more than the two they're separately. And then you've got the other ones like, well, if we split these apart, BHP did it not that long ago with
Billiton.
Yes.
Yep. South 32.
South 32. Thank you.
Yep.
And it's like, this is going to be brilliant. And I again, a bit cynical. A company is spinning something off because it doesn't want it. I mean, here's this great business unit. Let's get rid of it because that's going to be brilliant for shareholders. Because then we can focus over here. Give me a break, right? Like it's just, it's a complete nonsense. So the other thing is you can rest a little bit on the stats here rather than just shooting from the hip as I was. And we've quoted it a lot because it's a good stat,
yep.
Which is that generally these kinds of deals only add value to shareholders 1 in 3 times. Right. And the other third, it's sort of, it's a wash and then it loses money. And things look very good on a PowerPoint slide deck, yes, that are very hard to do. And yes, and you usually have things like synergies, efficiency gains,
cost savings,
cost, you know, all these kinds of things, which are just brutally, brutally hard to actually happen. And more often than not, it's the empire building of a board and management team than it is a hard calculus on what's beneficial for shareholders. So I'm usually skeptical of it. Yeah, nevertheless, it's nice if you hold something, yeah, and a takeover offer comes. Well, actually, no, I take that back. A couple times it's happened to me, I've been pretty annoyed by it because even though I got taken out at a higher price, I felt as though it was still opportunistic and I would have been better to hold the company through to fruition. So
let it play out.
Yeah. I guess it's a long ramble, but what I would say is when you're a shareholder in a company that is going through something like this, you know, try and play devil's advocate with it because it is never going to be presented to you as in like, this is a difficult decision that we have to make. It's a brilliant decision and you're going to love it is how it's picked every time, every time. And statistically, we know it's not.
My favorite example is the Tabcorp Tattersalls,
yes,
merger. So yes, Tabcorp, the gambling business, says, you know what? We should merge with Tattersalls. Then we'll have more diversity. We'll have the lotteries business. We'll have a gambling business. It'll be a great business. It's a great idea. We should definitely do this. It's going to add value, all the synergies and everything else, cost savings. And for those who followed the story, Tabcorp then spun off the Lottery Corporation, which was the old Tattersalls, because they were better businesses apart, because each could then focus on what it was doing and et cetera, et cetera. BHP, you're at BHP. The other one's the BHP Oil Assets. Oh, yeah. Where BHP said, we're getting rid of the oil assets, spinning off to Woodside. It's going to be great for Woodside shareholders and great for BHP shareholders. And then, well, hang on, who actually wins out of that deal? You're taking the same assets, you're dividing it into two pieces. It's, I will say one thing, mate. I will be a little less cynical than you, which is unusual for
That's
me.
That's unusual.
Yeah, it is. There is no value created by definition. But it is possible, and this is where, again, nuance is important. It's possible that there is more value recognized by the market because there are different groups of shareholders. And the Motley Fool, this is not an ad, we run different services. We run some high growth services, some income services, right? We run some for 25-year-olds, some for retirees. And the same company won't fit in both portfolios because some investors don't want that, but they want the other one and vice versa. Now, if your Crown did this or tried to do this ages ago, speaking of businesses in trouble, they tried to spin off the property assets from the gambling assets and basically say, you know what? There are property investors who will invest in listed property because they want certain things out of it. There are equities-based investors who want operating businesses with growth potential, and they're going to pay a certain amount for that. Now, if you try and sell a combination of both, no one really wants the hybrid version because I don't really want the property with the casinos, or I don't really want an operating business with the property. I'm going to choose one or the other. And I think there is genuine, very, very short-term, I won't say value creation because that's a ridiculous phrase invented by investment bankers to justify their fees. But there is very real short-term opportunity and maybe even the natural owners of some assets. So speaking of PE, I'll finish my point. It is possible two separate businesses owned by two separate groups of shareholders who value things differently. It's game theory 101. We all know game theory, right? One of those great ideas of, this is a bit of a, you know, unfortunate example, of a divorcing couple where they say, you got 100 points each. You can allocate those points against any of the assets that we have. And what you find is when you add those things up, each person gets more than 100 points worth of value because I might value the car, she might value the couch. I might value the cat, she might value the dog. Whereas if we said we're going to have half each, we're like, well, I don't really want that half, but that's, it is what it is, right? So when you start to think about that, there is some obvious and real benefit, not value, but benefit from separating those shareholder groups. But there is absolutely no value actually created. It's just a realization of value. And I can see some tiny amounts of justification for some of that. The problem is, to Ram's more cynical point, is it's generally investment bankers who walk in and say, I can create value for you. I can get your shareholders to give you some more money and a bonus, and you can be on the board of this and the CEO of that, both mergers and divestitures as they go through for exactly those reasons, right? And you can always make a case. And they believe, that's the other thing. I've been in corporate boardrooms where a management team has said, after a long due diligence, everyone gets invested in the process. And this is the problem with, again, psychological biases we talk about regularly. By the time you spent 6 months working on a deal, no one can see how that deal could possibly go badly because you're so invested in getting it done. You want to believe. And there's no more, ask Mulder and Scully, there's no more, for the kids, that's an old TV show, don't worry. There is no more, there's no stronger, you know, psychological bias, I don't think, that I want to believe. I will put aside any misgivings because I so badly want this to be true. I will, you know, not even consciously, subconsciously blinker all that stuff out. Yeah, that could happen, but it's probably not going to. I'll probably be fine. I think there's some reality to that as well. I think if the world was, are there any investment bankers in the room before I say this? No one's going to put their hand up anyway. I think if there were fewer investment bankers in corporate boardrooms, shareholders would end up with a lot more money. Put it that way.
Yeah. I mean, look, there are instances where it's incredible.
Yep.
Like that it can change a company. I've used the Prometicus example before. They bought Visage, you know, and that is.
Talk about sliding doors.
You never would have heard their name,
no.
Right? And that is, they were doing practice management software before they were doing PACS, you know, medical image storage and retrieval and all this kind of thing. And it has made them one of the most successful companies ever on the ASX, one acquisition.
Yeah.
So it can work and it can work very, very well. The thing to I always think is what is it that you can bring to this business with your existing assets and brands, et cetera, that business can't do?
Because yeah.
Sometimes there is a 1+1=3 scenario.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm sure, you know, Coke could do a lot better with, give me another soft drink brand.
Pepsi.
Thank you. Than I could, right? Like there are legitimate synergies are a real thing.
Yep. That's a great example, actually, because you think about the economies of scale. You've got a truck going to a place.
Yeah.
If you throw an extra couple of pallets of drink on a truck, cost you no more for the truck probably because you've got to pay the driver and the fuel and the rent on the truck and the lease and whatever else. If you can fill it rather than having half full, there are genuine economies of scale with growing volume.
Yeah. I would, yeah. And to bring it to a practical point, if you've got shares in a company and it's going through something like this, particularly let's speak about divestitures because they're the ones that are sort of happening, ask what they're getting rid of because you'll get both. You'll get shares in both and it's probably only one that you want. Mm. It doesn't matter what they've told you, right? Like you just don't get rid of something good. So if I was more prepared and had done some due diligence, I would have done some research here because I can guarantee you that almost any split that you've seen, it has been two different outcomes, mm. almost without exception. Just be careful.
There you go.
Don't buy the spin.
Mate, let's finish with a bit of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Overnight, there's a brand new social network.
Oh, yes.
Listed on the World Stock Exchange. It's not Twitter. It's not Facebook. It's not Instagram. It's not WhatsApp. Truth Social.
You forgot X.
No, I said Twitter. We had this conversation, by the way. Andrew insists on calling them posts. I call them tweets, and I will always call them tweets because I just am that bloody-minded. I like to do that. Trump made more money in a day than he had, even on the most generous of assumptions.
You got to give it to the guy.
Before he listed this company, he was worth on the most recent, I think it was Fortune or Forbes, $3.1 billion. After the last court case, maybe you can halve that. I'm not sure. $4 billion richer as a result of reverse listing Trump Technology and Media and Technology, into a shelf company they kind of tried to merge it into. The shares are up 50% at one point, closed up 15%. This is a business that is doing tens of millions in revenue.
Tens of millions.
Worth $8 billion US.
Wait. Tens of billions, that sounds like a lot. It's not when you're looking at these
tens of millions. That's right.
Tens of millions. It's not a lot of money, but that's the top line. The bottom line is negative hundreds of millions. So, I mean, in a way, you kind of got to go. Wait a second. If you and I started a social media app,
yes.
And we were just getting 10 or 20 million a year at the top line, bleeding cash, and we listed at that price. I mean, there's nothing you can do except sort of go, bravo. Like, you found people that were that dumb? Because this thing's gone to zero. I mean, it's not even a a comment on Trump, you know. But you have got these people in such a lather that they will buy monkey JPEGs because he was selling NFTs at one point. Trump yep. NFTs, and now he's dumped on retail in the classic cynical move. He's it's a family podcast. I won't use the term, a rubbish stuff, company. Stuff.
Yeah, well
done. And he got away with it. And so, I mean, as much as it blows your brain away, you just think, well, bravo.
I heard it called the ultimate meme stock today. And it was fascinating. You know, I think this is both it's a lesson and maybe a warning or an opportunity. I'm not sure which. If you think about any company only needs enough true believers to make it worth something. And if you're going to list that company, you only need enough true believers to buy the shares, right? And whatever your political affiliation.
You've mentioned that with Elon before.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. The power of a cult. And I don't use that. I do use it a bit disparagingly actually about Elon because, you know, he's a bit special. But the same is true as Truth Social, right? There are just the true believers. And there's two ways this goes, right? If you could find enough buyers perpetually for shares in Trump media and technology, there's no reason for this to be a bad business. Oh, sorry, bad stock specifically, right? No matter how it goes financially.
There's one reason it goes bad.
Go on.
Financially.
Well, but what I'm saying is that there's enough true believers who keep buying it from you. This is the thing about sentiment,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's very true, but it's the whole weighing voting machine kind
that's
of thing.
That's my point.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. 100%, that's 100% my point. And as long as, this is the thing, right? So NFTs went through the roof for a very, very long time. Why? Because there are enough true believers being added to the cult over time to keep the machine rolling until it stopped. When was the last time we saw a headline about an NFT? Non-fungible token, for those who can't recall the acronym. It's supposed to be the next big thing. Twitter had them. You could have it as your profile picture on Twitter. It's going to be wonderful. They're selling monkey pictures.
Kevin Hart just sold his recently for a 98% loss or something.
That's a lot, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. So now, that being said, we've talked a lot about companies. CSL has always been stupidly expensive on the ASX, right? To its credit, it keeps growing, but it's always had a PE which has been larger than its growth because people have chosen to believe that this will continue to be the case. Do you remember Fleetwood?
I used to have shares in Fleetwood.
Right. So I think I did too. Fleetwood was a mobile home
builder. I don't
know
why I admitted to that.
Yeah, I did too. Fleetwood was effectively a mobile home builder that used to provide demountable tile accommodation for mining camps, right?
It was the mining boom, just to put context here. And it was a pick and shovels play. I'm just going to save us some face here. So you could make this really nice
We're not thesis, saving face, dude.
You know, it's just like, well, it doesn't really matter what the mines do. They're going to demand these kinds of things. These guys have been family-run business, have been doing it for years. The books are really clean. The mining boom didn't boom forever.
And that's the thing. So for a very long time, this business was the best thing since sliced bread. The business did well because the mining boom rolled on. And what happens? The true believers see those numbers and say, look what it's doing. Look what it's doing. Look what it's doing. And when you get in that state, you can't believe there is a time in which the music stops. We've seen that. I mentioned lithium earlier. I'm sorry for anyone who's here or listening who is a lithium company shareholder. We've seen that story play out. Now, it's not over. I could have egg on my face in 12 months' time with lithium price 10x's from here, and I'm not doing this again next year because you'll all hate me at. But, you know, assuming it doesn't, we might be back here next year. And the reality in terms of what that trend can look like, you made the point, and this was the point I was going to make, so Andrew stole my thunder beautifully, is at the end of the day, with very, 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 very rare exceptions, the market remains a weighing machine. You can ride sentiment for a while. If you're really, really lucky, you can ride the sentiment far enough. Can I mention Afterpay? For any Afterpay shareholders here, went from $1 to $150, and people looked at the merger and the buyout by Square and said, look, I'm a genius. See how much they paid? Square's now worth less as a company than the price they paid for Afterpay. Now, I'm not blaming. If you made some money on it, good. Sorry?
It's called Block.
It's called Square. I refuse to move into the modern age. I'm still living in 1973 and you can't stop me. Block/Square. Is worth less now. Maybe that's why it's worth less.
I'll tell you why it's called Block later.
Thank you. I won't be listening. I'll be at the bar. the reality is that when the music stops, right? So if you're really, really lucky, maybe you get out at the right time. Maybe you own the company, the stock, that defies gravity forever or for eventually forever because people believe for long enough. It's two things. Don't buy the sentiment. Whatever the company, whatever your political views, whatever your social, whatever it is, don't buy the story, buy the business. Secondly,
don't buy anything that Trump has touched. I think you can actually say that objectively, right?
Like that's better than my
Trump
answer.
University and the stakes he had at once. They're like every single one a disaster.
Do you know there's a Donald Trump Bible?
Yes, I did.
I wasn't going to go into this one. And it's marketed as the only Bible endorsed by Donald Trump, which I got to figure the bloke upstairs doesn't need Donald Trump's endorsement, but I don't know. Maybe he does.
Again, genius. Like, it just, like, you got away with that? What?
It's got a copy of the U.S. Constitution, I think the National Anthem, and some song written by a country music singer.
A picture of him hugging the flag on the back.
I'm not entirely sure. On that wonderful note, we are going to finish this podcast. Will you come back on Sunday?
Yes, I will.
Will you have done an ultra marathon in the meantime?
You know I will. And drink some beers along the way.
We will have maybe a beer or two. Make sure you do rejoin us on Sunday. For those of us here at the pub, please stay, have a drink. We'll be back in about 15 minutes. And until then, full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.